Monster Man, special episode, Classic Movie Monsters. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity of my Patreon backers, and specifically by the generosity of Patreon backer Jason Connerly. Jason asked me to discuss favorite fantasy movies, and goes on to explain that for his money, Conan the Barbarian is probably the best sword and sorcery movie, but his favorite fantasy movie is probably Excalibur. Mind you, he says, I grew up with the Ralph Bakshi and Rankin Bass Tolkien movies, and prefer them to the newer films, so my tastes may be dated. You know, we went on to talk about what monsters appear in these, and so I'm going to talk about fantasy film in general, and then specifically monsters, and then finally my favorite monster from the kind of golden age of fantasy movies. And of course, everybody's got a different golden age. I think there are really two anyway, but we're going to talk about the 80s because it sounds like Jason grew up with a lot of the same films that I did. If you'd like to be like Jason and request a discussion of a particular monster for a special episode, all you need to do is go over to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 or higher level. And if you do, you'll also get access to my other podcast, Patron Deities, which is about the Deities and Demigods book, and other bonus content, like an episode that I uploaded this week about Jeff Smith's cartoon classic, Bone. So Jason, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoy this episode. Just judging from the films that Jason references, mostly which come from the 1970s and early 1980s, it seems like the fantasy films that we're talking about here are the ones of the post-D&D era. Like, when you look at early D&D, you can definitely see that it was influenced by a certain type of fantasy adventure film. Specifically talking about your kind of Ray Harryhausen stuff. Now, some of those things will have actually come out after D&D was released. For example, when you look back on Clash of the Titans, it can seem like a fun exercise in nostalgia until you realize it came out the year after The Empire Strikes Back, and then it seems so terribly, terribly dated. I think there's a genre of those type of, you know, special effects-y, Ray Harryhausen-y adventure films that blends into other kinds of serial adventure fiction that was obviously a big influence on early D&D. And then you get this kind of like second generation sword and sorcery stuff. Now, obviously, all of these films from the early 1980s are jumping off of the success of Conan the Barbarian. So in the same year that Conan comes out, you get, you know, the Beastmaster, you get Ator the Fighting Eagle. This genre of fantasy movies about a muscular shirtless man, let us call them Fonans. And these are clearly the heirs of the existing sword and sandal or peplum movie tradition, right? Your Hercules versus the Moon Men and all those other kind of low-budget Italian or whatever muscle adventure movies. And as a result, they tend not to actually have all that much in the way of monsters. There are some cases where a film is very effective in its presentation of a monster, but for the most part, not so much. And this, I think, is largely to do with, firstly, the traditions that they inherit from the genres of films that they're part of, and secondly, the budgetary and technical limitations that they're working under. So in the Conan films, for example, you get human enemies, you get a lot of wild animals, you get some sort of ghosts, and you get a sorcerer. So this is to say that Conan typically has a villain rather than a monster. In Conan the Destroyer, you get a more impressive monster, but again, only at the very end, right? That is a big deal. It presumably used up a good amount of the effects budget, and therefore has to be focused on, you know, the climactic revelation. That's obviously something that a game doesn't have to deal with. You know, you could be fighting nothing but Atiogs from the start to the finish, although that wouldn't be a very exciting scenario, but you understand what I mean, in that we don't have to kind of respect the narrative pacing that requires us to only unload the weird stuff in giant significant sequences. If you watch a trailer for a Harryhausen adventure film, by contrast, it's nothing but special effects stuff. There's a plot and characters to this movie, sure, whatever. But the assumption is very much that you're there for the skeletons. And the Fonans are even more like that. You're very likely to get monsters that fall into one of two categories. Either people and people wearing masks, so things like zombies. There's some kind of like zombies or cavemen or something at the beginning of Deathstalker, for example. Or there's the kind of pig brute ogre-y dude that Deathstalker fights at the end of that movie, or in the final gladiatorial fight anyway. And, you know, it's clearly just a guy, a big muscly guy wearing a Head and Shoulders mask. That movie, by the way, if you watched it a long time ago and you have fond memories of it, I wouldn't rewatch it if I were you. It was quite disturbing. I guess that's all I can say. So what that means is that, for the most part, these aren't the stories that you go to looking for interesting monsters, right? And it's interesting to see how many of these, like, these films have very basic Monster Manual level monsters. Like, pretty much every creature in these movies is in the Monster Manual. Like, that big muscly guy is like an orc or an ogre, various wild animals and so forth. You get some spiders in Ator the Fighting Eagle, all kinds of witches and shape changers and things like that. But in general, not a lot of innovation on the monster front. You sometimes, in other films, you might get some, particularly in animated films, I want to say, you might get some twists on an existing, widely understood mythological monster. So an example of that would be, I don't know, The Last Unicorn. I think it's also from 1980. Something like the complex ecology of dragons in that old TV movie, The Flight of Dragons. I don't know if you watched that, but it's very influential on me at a young age. I haven't seen it in decades, and I still remember that theme song. And you might get visually impressive renditions of monsters, like, for example, the orcs in the Bakshi Lord of the Rings films, who have a great, really memorable and cool visual appearance, you know, one that has never really been duplicated because it's so distinctive. And as a kid, I thought it looked weird and compelling, even though I could obviously see that it had some kind of technical limitations. So the fantasy genre in film in the 1980s seems like it's a good distance behind where role-playing games are, right? It hasn't really reached the point of innovation in terms of creating monsters. Meanwhile, wild innovative monster creation is going on in the sister genre. So over in science fiction, people are making all kinds of crazy stuff, right? This is the era of Alien, Star Wars. All sorts of weird creatures are being designed as space aliens rather than fantasy monsters. And I think that's because some aspect of nostalgia is so fundamental to the fantasy films of that era. And if you want to say to the fantasy genre in general, you know, that's a conversation. I don't 100% agree, but I think you have a point. So that is that fantasy films tend to replicate the things that you're primally afraid of, right? Wolves, snakes, spiders, hooligans, witches, all very fundamental folkloric human fears. Well, and obviously that's certainly true of something like Alien, but it kind of chops them up and recombines them in different ways. At the same time, this is an era in which science fiction is obviously drawing on fantasy and historical tropes. The most obvious example would be Star Wars, where there's an old holy man in the desert who has a magic sword and a, you know, a black knight. Now, obviously I'm not going to go and say that a creature from Star Wars is my favorite fantasy monster from a movie of the 80s. That might be pushing things a little too far, and on this podcast, we push things just far enough. And that is why I want to talk to you about Krull. When I was a kid, Krull astounded me. I don't know why. Krull was one of my favorite movies. My brother and I, my mother used to have a video camera that she would use for her job, and we would use it to make little movies of our own. And one of the ones that we kept trying to make was a sequel to Krull. And I have no idea whether my brother cared about this at all, but for some reason, Krull fascinated me. Now, as an adult, I can see that one of the reasons that Krull is so compelling is also one of the reasons that it's such a failure as a film, which is that it just makes no sense. Its plot is a series of barely connected episodes strung together without any semblance of sense or motivation. And even the end of it is a huge, goofy anticlimax. But when you see these things as a kid, you almost take them in more as a succession of images than a coherent plot. And Krull was full of not only kind of stock fantasy things, the horses racing swiftly with their hooves aflame, you know, people sinking in quicksand or people doing magic spells, you know, that stuff's all very pretty much what you'd expect, but there was so much more to it in a way that was weird and unsettling and compelling. Now, if you haven't seen Krull, you must have no idea what I'm talking about. This isn't the right place to have a long discussion of it. You should go and watch it. I mean, it certainly something. Like, it's not boring. I'll give you that. It's sometimes actually boring. The point is that Krull is a 1983 fantasy film. It is directed by Peter Yates, and it stars actually quite a lot of people. It's got early performances from people like Liam Neeson and Robbie Coltrane. It's got people like Alan Armstrong in it. It's, you know, it's got the usual raft of kind of British and Irish character actors. And it's a story of an alien monster who's controlling the world, and the last hope to stop him is this prince and this princess and a magic weapon. The baddie kidnaps the princess. The prince goes on a quest for the magic weapon, but in the end, it turns out that the only weapon that can defeat the monster is love. It's fine. I mean, it's not fine. It's dreadful. But the reason that I mention it is that it has, unlike most fantasy films of its generation, it has really weird and interesting monsters. And this is a show about monsters. And these monsters are great because the bad guy, the Beast, as he is inventively known, and his minions are very inventive compared to what you might find in fantasy films of that era. I'm not saying that it's as good as The Dark Crystal, but it has that thing where it has aspects that are reminiscent of traditional fantasy, but presented in a new and unique way. Now, the difference between something like Krull and something like The Dark Crystal is that The Dark Crystal is a single coherent aesthetic vision. Krull is a bizarrely jarring juxtaposition of elements that don't belong together, which for my monster purposes almost makes it work better. So the idea is that the Beast has come to the planet of Krull in his black fortress, which is like a big old weird organic portable dungeon that he flies around and lands wherever, and he's sent out his army of slayers. And slayers are very clearly meant to be, what if we did a fantasy take on stormtroopers? Right, they're faceless goons in armor with zap guns, but in a real kind of like horror fantasy way. And if you haven't seen the film, you should just go put like Krull Slayers into YouTube, because they really are kind of interesting and compelling in terms of how they are presented. And I think they obey some of the rules for a good kind of goon monster in a Monster Man context. Because what you want out of a goon monster is an interesting visual design, a plausible motivation, and a couple of good gimmicks. So first off, the Slayers have got interesting visual design in spades. They look quite unlike other movie monsters of the era, even though they kind of recall things like the Stormtroopers. They're coherent with the kind of techno-organic visual design of a lot of the Beast's fortress, and kind of the Beast himself, and sort of the Beast's other trappings. Like, at one point, he offers the princess a crown, which clearly recalls the sort of shoulders and neck of the Slayer's armor. And they also have this thing that they do when they die, where, like, when they get hit, there's kind of like a high-pitched squeal, and then their armor cracks, and this, like, wormy creature comes out of them and burrows down into the ground. So is the idea that actually these are sort of like humanoid mech suits that are being piloted by some kind of little worm guy? Or is that their brain, which is sort of separate? This would kind of make sense in that the design of the Slayer's armor sort of cradles and frames the head, which is where the worm thing comes out from. I don't know. They just look really cool. And they have a sort of zap gun lance kind of thing, which we often see them rotating, which seems to be kind of how they reload them. No, actually, now that I look at this clip on YouTube, I see that what it is they shoot out the lance blades on one end of their spear thing, and then they reverse it to go stab people with the other end. So that's even better. It gives them a one-shot ranged attack, which is always nice for an enemy. And it's just a good, solid look. There's also a little variation, because you do see them in sort of different colored uniforms, I guess. Now, again, these are just the usual lumbering goons. They walk slowly at the goodies and zap them with their zap guns, and they're not terribly good shots. They do hit the occasional person, which is nice. They're kind of a cut above stormtroopers, really. But they're enigmatic, which is one of the things, you know, when I was younger, I tended to be really fixated on things that didn't make a lot of sense, that were enigmatic in that way. And I've talked before, I think, about how that's a lot of the appeal of comic books for me when I grew up. Like, you know, there wasn't Wikipedia and there weren't online sites, and a lot of the time you would just be reading like one issue in a longer story, and it would just be so confusing, but kind of tantalizingly confusing. And that's how I feel about the Slayers. Now, in researching this episode, I've read a couple of sort of online articles or blog posts about the Slayers. There's not very much out there about them because, you know, Krull's not very good, and then it wasn't developed in any further media. But there are intimations in the film that the Beast, the baddie, in addition to being a big space alien, is kind of a sort of devil figure in that he offers people deals that work out in a kind of poetically punishing sort of way. Now, this is how the Cyclops gained his ability. The reason the Cyclops only has one eye is a bit like Odin trading his eye. You know, they traded it for the ability to see the future, but as a result, they know when they're going to die. But this is presented in kind of like an occulty stroke technological kind of way, which I think is fun and interesting. So you definitely get this sense that, you know, the Beast has been on other worlds and has made deals with other species. And so it's possible that this is some kind of alien species that has a deal with the Beast where they kind of become his soldiers. They don't seem to be animated, they're obviously not animated constructs, and they're obviously not mindless. We see Slayers, like, hesitating or being confused sometimes. So they're definitely soldiers, but they're not human soldiers, unless the human is somehow bonded with that creepy screaming worm thing. And so that gives them a possibly tactically exploitable gimmick, right? Like, you might be able to target them for headshots or whatever. It gives them a relationship with the Beast, like, oh, there's an army of Slayers taking over the land, but if we can take out their leader, then the bargain will be broken and they might all just turn around and go home. It gives you the opportunity to have sympathetic Slayer characters, that there might be some who have overcome the Beast's control of them and are just, like, trying to get by. You can imagine that the different colored uniforms give them different functions. They're a bit like video game enemies, so you could have more than one type of Slayer, you know, maybe armed with different weapons, maybe having different levels of ability or whatever, so you can kind of distinguish your horde. The Beast does seem to have other kind of, like, characterful lieutenant creatures. There are other encounters with different monsters, some who are just mostly just kind of like natural hazards of the world, but it's easy to see that the Beast could have, like, picked up other henchmen on his travels throughout the universe. So you can kind of distinguish all those generic kind of cobra soldiers with more colorful characters to kind of put some chocolate chips in that cookie. I'm not going to pretend that this isn't all just a post facto justification for why I like Slayer so much, because it 100% is. But I think it's also the case that of the fantasy movies of the 80s, Krull provides the most kind of D&D-able stuff, or at least provides a lot of D&D-able stuff. Indeed, there were rumors that it was supposed to be a Dungeons & Dragons movie, although Gygax denied it. And I believe, and Luke Slater will know more about this than I do, but I believe that it was occasionally sold or released under the title Dungeons & Dragons, although possibly not, like, officially or in an authorized way. It's relatively easy to run a Conan the Barbarian type of setting. A lot of OSR gaming is focused on stripping down the fantastic world of D&D and making it more like that classic sword and sorcery look, right? Where monsters are unique, magic is relatively rare, sorcerers are the baddies, and you're just rogues trying to rely on luck, cunning, and occasional unreliable magic to make your way through this world that is not otherwise. You know, there aren't potion shops on every corner. There aren't, you know, your next door neighbor's not a dragonborn. I maybe tend more toward the other direction in that I tend to like surreality to a certain extent. And I think, you know, Krull fits that bill pretty neatly. Again, it's not good, but is definitely this very fairy-tale-y movie that involves a big space monster and his army of worm robots, which is more than you can say about most other fantasy films from the 80s. So as much as I love Conan, and I genuinely think Conan the Barbarian's a good movie. Most of its imitators are definitely not. I have, for some reason, seen Ator the Fighting Eagle twice, and it's just, I mean, it's dreadful. I watched Deathstalker earlier today, and it's no good. But the, you know, Conan is genuinely pretty good, partly because it has just, like, the texture and richness that thing needs, and partly because it's made with this combination of wild unpredictability and sort of, like, dumb wholehearted sincerity. Also, this is an amazing soundtrack, which doesn't hurt. Krull's got a pretty good soundtrack too, actually. It's James Horner. It's all right. Anyway, I think that most of those films don't actually provide an enormous amount of inspiration for a D&D game, right? You can look at a fantasy film from the 80s and go, oh yeah, I could do this with D&D. Simple. This is all in the Monster Manual. I just mostly have them go into the wilderness. You know, we maybe have a little sandier bit of an aesthetic. But even the plot of, say, Deathstalker. Deathstalker is a bit of a better example, actually, than something like, I don't know, Ator the Fighting Eagle, because Ator the Fighting Eagle is one of the ones that relies on the idea that kind of the main character is the chosen one. Deathstalker's plot is essentially, there's an evil sorcerer who rules this kingdom, and he is going to host a big gladiatorial tournament to have all the bravest warriors in the land fight the idea that he's going to leave his throne to the next one. But a secret plot is that he's just going to use this to kill off every hero in his kingdom, right? They're all going to kill each other for his benefit, and then he's going to kill the weakened winner, and then he'll be unstoppable. Meanwhile, he's taken as a hostage into his harem, the daughter of the previous king, and that king is sitting around in the woods imploring heroes to go get her back. And so the player characters are just like a ragtag bunch of people who are all on their way to this tournament because they all believe that they can be the greatest warrior in the land. You can definitely see how it would represent a D&D game, and in terms of providing a simple outline for a plot, it might contribute something to a D&D game, but I don't think it gives as much weird material to incorporate as something like, say, Krull. Again, not an endorsement of Krull as like a good film, but it has a certain charm, and I think, you know, if you watch it maybe while you're folding laundry or making dinner or something, you'll be entertained. So, rather than an overall survey of fantasy films of the 80s, I settled on Krull and specifically the Beast and the Slayers as things that I would include in a D&D campaign. Again, you want to test your campaign's tolerance for how much space weirdness it can handle. But I don't know, maybe it's watching a lot of Masters of the Universe as a kid, but I can handle a high degree of space weirdness. I like a bit of space weirdness in my games. Anyway, Jason, I hope that you've enjoyed this little digression down one of the gems, of 1980s fantasy cinema. I hope to hear more from the rest of you, either on the Patreon comments or on Twitter or wherever, about your favorite fantasy films of the Golden Age, and if you want to rake me over the coals for saying that, you know, the 80s is the Golden Age rather than, the kind of Harryhausen era, I quite agree with you, honestly. Like, I'm trash. And if I didn't say it before, Krull is, of course, an attempt to cash in on Star Wars, not an attempt to cash in on Conan, which is why it's so different from all the other things. Anyway, like I said, Jason, I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you so much for your continued support of Monster Man. It means a lot to me. This has been a special episode. As I said, if you want your own special episode, all you got to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 or higher level. Our next episode is going to be a return to the C chapter of Monster Manual 2, where we're going to talk about, among other things, cheetahs. So please join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please